Alright, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 61 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the Junior and Senior High. Today we're going to complete our look at the decline and fall of Greece by finalizing our story of Alexander the Great. So let me just tell you kind of where this fits in our ongoing efforts. In terms of looking at the schedule is the crucial thing here. If I can bring up the class webpage right here, and we look at the February spot here, right? Evidently, test 4 has not happened yet. It's just coming up on the 18th. So it's been moved back by about 2 weeks. It's coming up on the 18th, but notice what that does for us. What it does is, here we are on the 10th, tomorrow's History Through Art. When we come back next week, it will be a short week. So Washington's birthday is on Monday, and then, well, we've only got a 3-day week. So on Tuesday will be the review, and Wednesday will be History Through Art, and Thursday will be the test prep class. So we're not going to have a lecture of new material on Monday, since that is a day off. So this basically is the last lecture of new material in this segment of the course. That's the key point. So what will happen is I will send you the remainder of the class notes before the 15th. And then I will post the test preparation sheets and send them by email as well on the 15th, even though we don't have a class. So I still want to give you the 3 days. For those of you who need it, can use it, I want you to have it. So you will still receive the test prep sheets on Monday. Okay, so be aware of that. And so that's really key. All right. Questions or comments about that? A little bit of a difference there from what we're used to, of course. Alrighty. Well then, let's get to it. Let's get back to, well, the ruler of Macedon that has been catapulted to the leadership of Greece. We have this half Macedonian, half Greek prince named Alexander, who takes after his father Philip, and who is in charge of Greece, and decides that the purpose of Greece now is going to be the conquest of Persia. So we saw this spectacular representation of the scope of his activities, which is massive even when we look at it here. But I think another good measure here and another good way to understand what we're looking at is we're looking at something that's comparable in size to the United States. So that, I think, is, you know, something that could be a powerful, you know, image for you, right? If we were to overlay the United States, this is like the West Coast to the East Coast. I mean, it's a really massive empire. And this is in archaic times, right? It's not modern times with modern industrial transportation or anything. It's an absolutely huge territory for that era. It's absolutely gigantic. So what we saw last time is that Alexander makes his way from Greece across the Hellespont, wins the Battle of the Granicus against that satrap, then liberates the Ionian colonies, goes to Gordium, right, to cut the knot and kind of pronounce himself the expression of the prophecy, right, the culmination of the prophecy that he's going to be the ruler of Asia. Then he goes down, defeats Dariush at the Battle of Issus, Then he takes the fortress at Tyre, right? We saw last time, by building the land bridge across to the island, and then gets down to Egypt. So this is where we left off last time. Alexander arrives in Egypt and becomes the pharaoh. All right, so now this is where we have to contend with, have a deeper discussion about the meaning of Alexander. What did he do? What does his presence in the timeline actually represent? And it's not good. it's not good at all. Because, and it's partly symbolized by what happens in Egypt. Now, sometimes you'll read, and I certainly recall reading in this context, that Alexander was viewed as a liberator of ancient Egypt. But I don't like that usage at all. If I was to say that, I would put big scare quotes around the word liberator. Just because he is overthrowing Persian rule, right, does not mean that we can use that concept, liberate. Because that means something. And when you understand that it means something, you're not going to use it to describe something like what Alexander did. What would be a good example? Can you summon one? Of a liberation in history. Where's your mental file folder with things like that in it? Just to you know, launch this discussion here. What's a good example of a liberation in history? Keen, go ahead.
Cyrus the Great liberating the Jews?
Ha! That's an interesting one. No, I don't think it's a good example. It does mean that he allowed them to leave their Babylonian captivity, but he insisted on them staying in the Persian Empire. He conquered all of this Fertile Crescent region and kept them under his rule. So no. I'm not talking about ancient examples, because there aren't any. Sadly. Really, there aren't any. So, we gotta really, when we're talking about liberation, we're gonna be talking about modern examples. I mean, I get why you summoned that one, Keen, because it's in the ancient times, it's one of the most beneficent kind of examples we could come up with. But he's not liberating them. They're not free after that. Right? That's the point. What is liberation? What does that mean? Has anybody ever been liberated in history? Guys drawing a blank on that? There have been some. Think about the United States, the greatest liberator of all time. Theo, Rosie, are you guys trying to say something? No?
Yeah. I was thinking maybe when the United States pushed Germany out of France during World War II.
Yeah, absolutely. Great example, right? The liberation of Europe from Nazi Germany. That is liberation, right? The United States saving Europe from the Nazis. That's liberation. Give me another one. There's another really great one in American history. What are the most important wars in American history? What's one that involves liberation as a key theme? Timothy?
The Civil War?
Absolutely. The liberation, the emancipation of the slaves through the Civil War. So the North liberating the slaves in the South. Huge. Right? So those are examples where we can use a word like that. And it means something. It means that there are people who are oppressed and that are ruled and they are set free. That's liberation. So it's not just one country overturning the rule of another and then putting itself in charge. Because in World War II, for instance, you've got the United States liberating Western Europe, but you've got the Soviet Union overthrowing Nazi Germany in places like Poland and Hungary. But that's not liberation. Because what happens? Keen?
The people are just re-enslaved.
Yeah, exactly. You're just substituting one form of totalitarianism for another. Right? You get rid of Nazism and then you get communism. So that's not liberation. So you'll find it in the textbooks and but you gotta be careful. That word has meaning. And we wanna use it to celebrate when some people are granted or given liberty by others. That's a big deal. And Alexander did not liberate anybody. I mean, neither did Cyrus. I mean, he was manipulating them, and really is the most important thing that he was doing. Alexander didn't liberate anybody either. He did not give them any advantages that would have been, expected, let's say, of the Greeks in terms of self-determination and democracy and things like that that were better about Greece. He didn't go to Egypt and teach them those kinds of things, right? When he got to Egypt, he made himself the pharaoh. So that's not liberation. Here's Alexander's. Pharaoh name. On Egyptian monuments. It can be found. Remember how to spot a proper name in Egyptian hieroglyphics? How did Champollion begin to crack the code? Keen?
He noticed the circle around the hieroglyphics that made up the name.
Right. It's got to be a cartouche, as this is called. Right? And then if you can find that pattern repeating over and over again, okay, then you can start to, okay, pick apart the pieces of it and see, especially if you've got Greek that you can work with, right, then you can compare the Greek and the Egyptian. Well, so you have to read this like the letters on this overlay here. You have to read it from right to left. So the symbols are Alexander. Dros, in fact, because Alexander in Greek is Alexandros. So not quite like the modern Alexander. And so this is Alexander's cartouche, the symbol of his name in Egyptian hieroglyphics. So he makes himself the pharaoh, and he really embraces this role. And I think this is quite indicative of what he was like. He really did think of himself as a god king. So, yeah, I don't know what this is. I don't know exactly. I mean, obviously, one of the things, Rosie, is that they didn't have certain vowels in Egyptian writing. So it's just, they're just not written. They are assumed. So we can't make an, we can't make a perfect translation of it. Just like, for instance, Tutankhamun or Tutankhamen is the same thing. It's just people have different preferences about what vowel sounds they're going to insert between different consonants. Same thing here. Okay, so let's not worry too much about that. If we go back to the map of Alexander's conquest, though, we can see that he did something a little bit curious. After arriving in Egypt, he made a special pilgrimage to an Egyptian oracle. Now, that's not Greek, right? I mean, if you're a Greek, you're going to go to the Oracle of Delphi, if any, right? But as the Pharaoh, however, he went to the Amon Oracle way off in the Egyptian desert. The kind of thing, precisely, that a Pharaoh would do. So to this day, it's kind of a fascinating spot. It's known as the Siwa Oasis. So you can see this is modern Egypt, right? And this is the middle of the desert. But every once in a while in a desert, you get one of these places that's known as an oasis, where all this, you know, there's just some water there, and it's remarkable. And human life can exist even in that pocket in the desert. And so there was an oracle there, and Alexander went to it because he wanted some sort of, Egyptian mystical sanction for what he was doing. Right? He wanted to consult with an Egyptian oracle. Now, why bother? This is Alexander very much behaving like an Egyptian. And everywhere he went, he behaved more and more like the people that he was conquering rather than what he was. Theo, Rosie?
Well, I think it could be to make himself more believable as their ruler.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah, now that's definitely a good interpretation. And, you know, it doesn't particularly matter. When we encounter actions like this by historical characters, there's almost always two competing interpretations. And it goes like this. One of the interpretations is that the character is, genuine. The character of the individual is, actually believes in what he's doing. That's always one of the competing interpretations. And people love to be able to dig into the primary sources and try to come up with some reason, this or that. So one interpretation would be Alexander really believed in the Egyptian gods, and he wanted to hear from the oracle. Then there's the competing interpretation that's always there, which is the pragmatic interpretation. The pragmatic interpretation says he didn't care. He didn't believe, not really deep down inside. He was just going there because he needs to do the kinds of things that the Egyptians would want to see him do. And so he's just acting. He's just putting on an act, and it's just pragmatic, which means practical in the sense of doing what's expected of you, getting things done in the way that they're easiest to do. So, yeah, it's definitely possible, Theo, that it's one or the other. I'm inclined to take the first view when it comes to Alexander. I'm inclined to take the view that Alexander is what psychologists call a megalomaniac. In that literally that he had a neurotic personality and that he thought that his successes were a kind of divine sanction and that he was in fact some kind of god king, that he was wholly different from other people and that this was the secret of his success, was that he in fact did have some kind of mystical power and that it was real. He believed it. So let's see, because this is going to be kind of an interesting point. We're going to get to that shortly here. He certainly behaved like it. So then the question is, did he mean it? Right? He behaved like he thought of himself as a god king. But just like every pharaoh in history and every king of Persia and so on, we have to ask ourselves, did he personally really believe it? Or was he just going through the motions because he knew that was how you have power? It's one or the other. In the end, it doesn't matter because the outcome is always the same. So after consulting with the oracle, it seemed like he got a good answer. It seemed like he heard what he wanted to hear. And he began to hunt down the Persian emperor. So now he's going to penetrate into the heart of the Persian Empire. He's going to go from Egypt and cross into Mesopotamia. And we get to this battle here. It's called the Battle of Gaugamela in the year 331, which is probably the most pivotal battle in terms of the fate of the Persian Empire. And remember, yesterday we were talking about how a small army beats a big army. And this is kind of cool because there's a chance here to kind of look at. Let me see what I need. I want to bring this map up. Oopsie. Here it is. So this is cool because this is a map of the Battle of Gaugamela. It shows what I was talking about yesterday. Let me expand it as big as I can make it. And the left-hand side shows us the way things were at the beginning of the battle. And then the right-hand side shows us what Alexander did, which demonstrate the tactics that I was talking about yesterday. So notice when you're looking at the left-hand side at the beginning, what is this? What are the Persians trying to do? Looks pretty obvious. Right, we've seen this, a variation on this, and it's pretty formulaic, right? Theo, what's the maneuver called?
They're trying to surround.
Yeah, right. What do we call it? What's that maneuver called?
Outflanking.
Yeah. Okay. Or in this case, right, both sides, the double envelopment, right, outflanking on both sides, and they're doing it in a really raw and textbook form. They've got a larger army. And therefore, they can afford to kind of move their forces around the smaller army, which is going to be surrounded, right? And it looks like a really easy thing to do. But it's too formulaic. It's too obvious. And Alexander knows how this works. And what we see in the Battle of Gaugamela is him taking advantage of this. So what happens with this attempted double envelopment? All of these cavalry forces over here are drawn into a battle on the left. Okay? These guys create their defensive stations here and are going to occupy these forces. These guys, being commanded to enact double envelopment, all end up over here. Meanwhile, these Greek forces have been positioned because he knows exactly what's coming. They're going to be ready, and they're going to line up here and fight these guys. So what now occurs is that little tactical situation that the commander like Alexander needs. He needs an opportunity to create a small battle within a large battle. He needs to create a situation where, despite having less numbers, he can manipulate the course of the battle so that, in the most important way, he can win anyways. Why? How? Right? By creating a battle that he can win inside of the larger battle. Which is pretty much symbolized nicely here by this big, fat, dark arrow, which tells you the thrust of what Alexander did. He was prepared to exploit this gap that would be created as the Persians attempted the double envelopment. He knew that what this was going to do is create an opportunity here where the Persians would be weak. And if he could apply as much force as possible in that spot, this would cave in. And guess where Dariush is? He's right here. Well, that's scary. Because now your enemy is behind you and on your flank. And who's going to protect you? So all of this collapses at the back, and Dariush has to flee. Because his forces are not set up properly in order to be able to defend against that kind of a maneuver. So there's an example of a small army. This is a cool one. Small army defeating a larger army, taking advantage of Alexander's tactical awareness, realizing when the battle has shifted to create a situation that he can take advantage of. So he defeats Dariush here. Dariush flees. This opens up all of Mesopotamia, and you can see Alexander then goes down to the famous city of Babylon. So this is what we have, which we've already studied, but in history through art. Right? So now, in case you didn't already know, right? Because some of you, I'm sure, guessed already or had some sense of it previously. The great character in gold is Alexander. This is Alexander's triumphant entry into Babylon. Or as we analyzed it, at the head of his conquering army, a successful but somber golden-clad figure on an elephant-drawn chariot enters a defeated city as its new ruler. Parade of Conquest. Welcoming the new ruler. We had some good titles that captured what Charles Le Brun, this artist, is saying about this moment. Another good example. It's not a liberation. It's a substitution. So no wonder everybody's not celebrating. Nobody's throwing confetti, or it's not some kind of happy moment. Remember what we noticed about the flowers on the ground? And the color scheme, which is so brilliant by the artist here. Got all these colors here, right? Pardon me, we have all these flowers here. But they're kind of a dead and ugly, that's not a convincing set of flowers, is it? It's not happy times. It feels grim. There's music being played, but nobody's really happy, right? Because it's just one ruler substituting himself for the one that was there before. Is it good or is it not? Who knows? The people of Babylon couldn't possibly know. They're unsure. So, great painting. It really captures this kind of ambiguous moment. Is it better or isn't it? The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the famous structure in the background with the trees on top of it, symbolizes the location, but it's not, nothing obviously great about this. It's just a change of the guard. It's a change of rulers. So there's a look back at one of those paintings that we had a look at, and now we have the full context for it. We know it's Alexander's entry into Babylon. And the further he goes into Asia, the more he acts like a Persian king. And, well, probably the most upsetting kind of ceremonial conduct that Alexander insisted upon was that he insisted that anybody that entered into his presence would treat him like a Persian king. And so, because now, right, Theo, you're making the point, well, okay, is this just a way to be more accepted, or is it more? When you entered into the presence of a Mesopotamian ruler, or a Persian ruler, or a pharaoh, or a Chinese emperor, or an Indian Raja, how were you supposed to act? What was the premise in all of these archaic cultures? Well, here's a great symbolic representation of it. Oopsie. I wanted to get my... Ugh, I can't highlight this. This character down here, right? In English, we would call that prostration. In ancient Greek, it was called proskynesis. You were supposed to kneel down and touch your head to the ground. In China, it was called the kowtow. Right? You were supposed to kneel down in front of the emperor. This is not respect. What is this? Abby?
Possibly fear?
It's more, yeah, there's an element of fear in it, but what is this act of placing yourself like this, face down on the ground? So, in other words, what are you showing to the person? Worship is not a bad word, but you yourself are not exalted by this, right? It's not a sense of you communing with something that is wonderful or supernatural. What is it, Theo?
It's a sign of submission.
Yes, Rosie, perfect word. The word is submission, right? You place yourself down. You submit. Right, proskynesis is a sign of submission. So what do you think the Greeks would have thought of this? Alexander required, as he moved into Asia, he required that anybody that would enter his court would have to perform proskynesis, because that was the way that Asian kings ruled. Well, and now Theo's right that he wants to maintain certain forms. He wants his rule to resemble that of the other rulers, so that the people, in essence, will know how to behave. They will submit to him because that's what they do. That's what they're used to. That's the way that they are used to behaving with their rulers. But what about the rest of the people, the rest of the Greeks? How's he going to get them to act in the presence of the others that are watching, if we're going to be pragmatic about it, or truly in his own presence? If he thinks of himself as a god king, what do the Greeks need to do? I like that you brought up that point, Theo, because it gives me a chance to address it every single time. Notice that? Like, whether it's for show or whether it's because he really believes it, what do the Greeks need to do now? King?
They must also prostrate themselves.
Yeah, also have to prostrate themselves. Okay, but now put yourself in their shoes. Now we have a really profound clash of cultures. Because to the Greeks, what is a king? Here's a good question for just integrating what we've learned so far with regard to Greek culture. To the Greeks, what is a king? Theo, Rosie?
Well, it would be a tyrannos often.
Okay, fair enough, which means somebody chosen by the people, all right, or some member of the aristocracy, but basically, what is he?
Human.
Yeah, good answer. He's a man, that's all. So he could be a member of a privileged class, or he could be some warrior, he could be some Olympic champion, but basically he's one of you. He's a person. He's human. So the Greeks would have no place in their culture for this God-king concept, for this notion that some human being had some kind of special mystical status and was in fact more than human. So for them, this was really the worst thing symbolically. This insistence of Alexander's that they should prostrate themselves like this? Absolutely not. I mean, they didn't want to. And this became the source of a great deal of friction within Alexander's camp. Because the warriors and his commanders knew they had lived with Alexander all of this time. They knew the story. They knew every single action that had happened, and they knew all about Alexander's humanity. There was no question in their Greek minds of it. And so finally it boiled over, and at a party that Alexander had, he and one of his great commanders got into a big argument. And his commander's name was Clytus. And Clytus is actually depicted in multiple paintings by Charles Le Brun. This is him here. And you can see him in lots of different paintings of Charles Le Brun of Alexander. And he features very much. And he told Alexander that he reminded Alexander about this moment in one of the crucial battles where Alexander was almost killed. And had Clytus not saved him, he'd be dead. And so he yelled at him, and he was basically saying, "You're alive because of me." And they got into a big shouting match. And Clytus was dragged off, and he ran back in. Alexander, in a fury, killed him, which is what's depicted here. The death of Clytus. And so, to me, this is symbolic of... This is almost in a moment. And it would be great to have a painting of this, maybe a little bit more artistic. But... it doesn't quite do it, but it would be an amazing painting and a tragic painting that would symbolize what Alexander is to ancient Greece, the one who killed it, because that's exactly what he's doing. He's killing his great Greek comrade. Why? Over this argument that he is a god and is going to be this god king in Asia, which is not what the Greeks are. It's a betrayal of who they are, and they don't believe in that sort of thing. That's not how they want to live. And for that, Clytus dies. But Alexander believes, is convinced that he's going to rule the world, and continues So this is the outcome in terms of the sheer scope of what he accomplished. We already have it. We know that he extends his empire all the way to India. But at that point, that's it. His own men said, that's it, we're not going any further. This is too far from home. This is not anything that we want to do. We're not interested in this anymore. So they basically mutinied and said, we're not going to follow you any longer. So Alexander had to return to Mesopotamia. So we have here this, basically this location, if you trace it, is the Indus River. So that's it. He penetrates into India. He wins one big battle over here, but that's it. His men don't want to go any further. So then they go back to Susa, was one of the capitals of the Persian Empire. And then Alexander mysteriously dies. We don't know why. Possibly something like malaria. You know, some kind of disease of that sort. Possibly he was poisoned too, right? Who knows? By that point, it was really hard for his own men to remain loyal to him. And he dies very young. I don't know his exact age, but, you know, like in his 30s. And then, well, he's taken all of these Greeks and spread them throughout this Persian Empire and created these Greek colonies all over the place. And now he dies. And while this is one of those classic situations where you have an empire that exists because of one person. Do you remember what that's called? There's a certain name for it, a certain kind of monarchy that derives from the unique ability of a single individual. It's always very unstable, very temporary. Keen?
Charismatic
monarchy, exactly. Alexander's rule is a charismatic monarchy, I mean, to the extreme, right? So, and when a charismatic monarch dies, that's always going to be a really dangerous situation because the empire exists because of the individual. The individual's gone, then the empire's gone. And that's exactly what happened. Alexander's empire broke right back up into its constituent parts. So, without worrying about the details, and this map is in Greek, so sorry, there's no English version of it, but ignore the details, just look at the colors, right? After Alexander died, his generals all went to war with each other, and, well, the Persian Empire remained separate, the Egyptian part became separate, the Lydian part became separate, and the Greek part became separate. So it's just back to the same old situation. So it's a long, drawn-out... Well, it's not even a long, drawn-out battle between the various successors. But really, after that, they just settle into their traditional roles. And you've got these Greek rulers and dynasties ruling over these Asian kingdoms, but there's nothing special about them. They're just exactly like they were before. So Alexander comes and goes, and basically the outcome is that the Eastern Mediterranean world is exactly like it was before. Nothing, there's no great progressive outcome. There's no great change. Theo, Rosie?
I can think of one thing that changed.
Okay, go ahead.
All of the kingdoms are now ruled by Greeks, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So, what do you think that matters?
was Greek.
And did that matter?
So that caused various amounts of unrest and had minor outcomes.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. It's not zero. The outcome is not nothing. The change is not nothing. But I think you're absolutely right to say minor outcomes. Minor outcomes. Really, if we assess the course of history and the direction of all of these various cultures, starting with India and then Persia and then Egypt and then Greece, and we look at their trajectories over time, doesn't matter. The impact of the kind of thing that the Greeks did is, it's not Greek. It's just the same old archaic conduct, and therefore it just does not change the trajectory of civilization. These cultures remained archaic, and that's they never advanced. And Greece, sadly, went downhill. Which is exactly what you would expect. I mean, basically, you have this one culture that's taken these small steps forward, and then Alexander dilutes all of its energy in the conquest of this vast archaic land. What's going to be left of Greece? The Greeks have spent way too much time fighting each other, exhausting themselves through wars, and now their energies are diluted into this, and anything of their culture is not able to really stand up to this massive amount of other people's culture. So there's nothing left at the end. It's so afterwards, that's exactly how, what we see in art, what we see in pretty much every aspect of what follows Alexander, is we have this what's called Hellenistic culture. So Hellenic meaning Greek, and Hellenistic meaning a pale shadow of what was Greece. Semi-Greek, partly Greek, but not really, not fully, not with any of the vitality and the special qualities of what Greece was. So all of this just basically reverts to what it was, and, well, that's it. History is now moving somewhere else. If we can think of history as kind of like this invisible force, is gone. It's not, there's no progress to be found here anymore. Somebody else is going to do something that matters more. The torch is passed to Rome. So, when we come back after the test, that's where we go. We spend the rest of our time in ancient history looking at the Romans. They are going to accomplish quite a lot, and they, of course, are going to be this great imperial culture that immediately precedes Europe and has a really huge impact on history. But Greece's contribution is over at this point. By the time Alexander's empire breaks up, Greece's contribution is over. Luckily, it's in there and it's embedded in the culture, and there's such a thing as history, and there's such a thing as art, and there's such a thing as science, and there's such a thing as philosophy. All those things exist, and they are in these undercurrents in this archaic world. And the Romans are going to embrace some of them and keep them alive and keep them going. And eventually, despite the Dark Ages, the Europeans will rediscover them and re-embrace them as well. And finally, really, things will take off. But no thanks to Alexander, that's for sure. All right, that's it for Greece. So, tomorrow, back to history through art, and then we have our test next week, okay, folks? Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.